This week on the show, we covered the insights of the FreeBSD NetGraph tool behind the curtain of advanced networking. We are also announcing the launch of BSSG from Stefano Marinelli, his journey from dynamic CMS to Bash static site generator. Then we have an open ZFS cheat sheet by yours truly, dipping my toes in OpenBSD in Amsterdam, SSH keys from a command, SSHD's authorized keys command directive, and how JPMens can use it to good use. How to move Beehive VMs and jail containers from one host to another is another interesting piece of this episode, and much more in this week's episode on BSD. BSD Now, episode 609, Toe Dipping in Amsterdam, recorded on the 16th of April, 2025. This episode of BSD Now is brought to you by Tarsnap. Go to tarsnap.com/BSDnow to find online backup for truly paranoid people. And if you want to support this show in one way or the other, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/BSDnow. And we thank you in advance for that.
Hi, we are your hosts, Benedikt Reuschling.
And I'm Tom Jones, and this is the 23rd of April, 2025.
Oh, right. I'm off by one, it seems. 23rd. How could that happen? Oh, because I copied it from the old one. Copy and paste, though. All right, good. We're off to a good start.
I don't think you should dip your toes in Amsterdam. Like, where's... Can you swim in the canals? I don't think you want to...
What I've...
They're full of bicycles.
Yeah. So I was in Utrecht at the one-day BSDNL event, and the thing I saw there is they have canals, but there are no, like, protectors from people falling in if they're drunk.
So you fell in?
No, I don't, but I can see people when they're drunk. Do they have a lot of drunk people drowning later in the evenings because they fell in? Or why is that not a security issue? I don't know. We will get feedback at bsdnow.tv email as usual.
Please tell us about the time you fell in a canal.
Yeah.
I've never fallen in a canal. I was going to say, if we get enough feedback about falling in canals, I'll tell a story about when I fell in a canal. But I don't think I have.
No.
I avoided falling in a canal.
Netherlands is nice, and Utrecht was especially nice. And so
we have canals in Scotland.
What are they called? Protectors before that, so you don't get in. It's like waist high bars that don't
fences.
Yeah, not fences. Everywhere. Yeah, right.
Benedikt. Okay, so like canals in cities are like transit, but canals between places are transit as well, and you can't have a barrier all the way along. There are hundreds of miles of canal.
But in the city, when there's there was a canal, and then next to it was kind of a cafe, and people were sitting right next where they, if a misstep could have let them land in the canal.
Just don't fall in the canal.
Yeah, but
like, if it's fine to program in C, it's fine to not have fences by canals. Okay, this week we're going to talk about BSD and not falling in canals.
Yep.
First up in the headlines, we have an article from clarasystems.com, and I got rid of the author. A. Perlman. I don't know who that is. Inside FreeBSD NetGraph, behind the curtain of advanced networking. The FreeBSD operating system has long been recognized for its capabilities, serving as a foundation for various high-performance network infrastructures. A pivotal component of FreeBSD networking prowess is a modular framework known as NetGraph. To better understand the significance of NetGraph, we'll want to compare it to Linux NetFilter and see how it behaves in real-world scenarios, especially environments such as Juniper's JunOS and Cisco's iOS XR for Cisco phones. Introduced in FreeBSD 3.4, NetGraph is a graph-based kernel networking subsystem that provides a flexible framework for, that's a lot of two-syllable words in a row, a flexible framework for implementing new networking protocols. It allows developers to create complex networking topologies by connecting various process modules known as nodes in a graph structure. This modularity facilitates rapid development and deployment of new networking features, making it a powerful tool for developers. At its core, FreeBSD NetGraph operates on the principle of nodes and hooks. Each node represents a specific network function or protocol, and hooks are connections between these nodes. This design allows for dynamic assembly of complex network configurations by linking various nodes together. For example, you can construct a network path where packets pass through a series of nodes, each handling distinct operations such as encryption, compression, or protocol translation. Control messages facilitate communication between nodes, enabling configuration management of the network graph. This allows messaging systems for real-time adjustments to the network topology, providing administrators with granular control over data flow and processing. Understanding NetGraph requires an examination of its mathematical underpinnings, particularly in graph, queuing theory, and discrete mathematics. I don't know if it does. NetGraph in FreeBSD models networking as a directed graph, where nodes represent network components and edges are data flow connections. Each node has a finite degree of connectivity, forming dynamic adjacency graph allows real-time modifications. Packet traversal follows graph traversal algorithms such as depth-first search for dynamic routing and minimum spanning tree algorithms to prevent loops. The adjacent matrix dynamically updates, ensuring networks remain connected. NetGraph nodes process packets using queuing theory, with each node acting as an MM1 queue, where, and then an equation. Compared to Linux NetFilter, which applies static rules using hook-based filtering, NetGraph enables real-time graph restructuring, making it more efficient for complex routing scenarios. Dijkstra's algorithm is often used for load balancing paths dynamically. This graph-based dynamic architecture gives NetGraph an advantage in modular and high-performance networking applications, particularly in carrier-grade systems like Juniper's JunoS. While NetGraph offers a flexible graph-based approach to networking, Linux employs a different framework known as NetFilter. NetFilter provides a set of hooks within the Linux kernel networking stack, allowing modules to register callback functions that can inspect and manipulate packets at various stages of processing. This framework is leveraged by tools like IP tables and NF tables, which are used to define firewall rules and perform packet filtering. The primary distinction between NetGraph and NetFilter lies in their architecture. NetGraph's node and hook model offers a more granular and customizable approach, enabling the construction of intricate processing pipelines within the kernel. In contrast, NetFilter's hook-based system is designed primarily for packet filtering and NAT. If you've worked in networking long enough, you're bound to have encountered... Oh, sorry, okay, I missed the title, and so it doesn't make any sense now. How can I relate to this information? Well, JunoS and iOS XR... If you've worked in networking long enough, you're bound to have encountered one of these two, if not both. I've never dealt with either of these.
Okay. We'll see.
I just don't have any money, is the problem. People should be sending me routers, and then I could not use them. And like the pile of computers I don't use. Where NetGraph becomes obvious in how it has influenced the design of several commercial network operators, JunoS is built upon FreeBSD kernel and leverages its network capabilities to deliver high-performance routing and switching solutions. JunoS uses a modular architecture that separates the control and forwarding planes, enhancing system stability and performance. Similarly, Cisco's iOS XR employs a microkernel architecture that separates the control and data planes akin to the design principles employed by Juniper. This separation enhances system stability and performance, allowing for more efficient processing of network traffic. NetGraph works particularly well in very specific scenarios, namely flexibility, modularity, performance, and extensibility. You can dynamically assemble and reconfigure the graph. Developers can create reusable nodes that can perform specific functions, promoting code reuse and simplifying maintenance. Operating within the kernel enables high-speed processing of network packets, and new protocols and features can be integrated seamlessly by developing additional nodes and connecting them to the existing graph. As well as these good things, there's a few challenges. The graph-based architecture can become intricate, making it challenging to design and manage large-scale configurations. Troubleshooting within a complex graph may require specialized tools and expertise. Comprehensive documentation and community support are essential to effectively leverage NetGraph's capabilities. FreeBSD NetGraph represents a powerful and flexible framework within FreeBSD's networking stack, offering a unique approach to constructing and managing network functionalities. Its influence is evident in the design of advanced network operating systems like JunoS and iOS XR. By understanding the architecture and capabilities of NetGraph, network engineers and developers can harness its potential to build sophisticated and efficient networking solutions. Do you ever use NetGraph, Benedict?
Seldom, I have to say. But you wrote an article about it a while ago.
Never. I've only used NetGraph for Bluetooth, and not for a long time. The recommendation from the recommendation I disagreed with for Beehive was to use Netgraph Bridge, I never understood. It just seemed like absolute chaos to make people use such a complex system to bridge packets. And I said so as much.
Wasn't there some use case for for jails?
For bridging, but maybe I don't know. So I've never done jail networking. I've never wanted to use that absolute hell, which is jail networking. So I've always used VNet jails. And a big part of that is when I started doing FreeBSD work, VNet jails were turned on by default.
Yeah,
so
that's
chewed.
More easy to manage.
And they're just more logical to manage, and they're much more sensible. You're using normal networking stuff rather than weird jail stuff. So I managed to avoid touching any of this. Yeah. I know Netgraph is used for PPP. PPP.
PPPOE?
PPPOE?
Triple P?
No, okay. I have a joke about this, but I'm not going to tell you it. Like PPP. But I've never actually had a network that needs that either.
Yeah, so it was before my time. So,
I mean, people are doing 10 gigabit PPPOE, but nobody knows why.
Is it stable?
No, FreeBSD, no.
Yeah.
Linux, yeah, with vendor offload and firmware tricks and stuff.
Of course, yeah. Let's do other networking things, unless that article still has a couple of more things.
No, this article is not about networking at all, Benedict.
Oh, yeah, but Netgraph, Netgraph.
Yeah, well, next article is about a static site generator.
Yeah, that's why I'm excited. So this one is from Stefano Marinelli and yet another good blog post, and he's introducing or launching BSSG. And this is his journey from dynamic CMS to static site generator, and that's what the BSSG stands for. But first things first, he starts writing, I have had my own website practically forever. Back in the late 90s, I already had a web page on my ISP server, and since at least 2001, I've had my own homepage on my own server. I've never been a great graphic designer, let alone a skilled webmaster, so I've always tried to keep things minimal and compatible. Initially, like many others, I wrote HTML pages by hand. Yes, that's what you do. Then I used what you see is what you get creation tools, and eventually I landed on CMS, the content management systems of the world. Okay, so he describes a little bit the era of dynamic CMS. I liked CMS because they allowed me to focus on the content and not the correctness of the generated HTML. Thanks to them, I started writing my first blog shortly afterward. Over the years, I've used many tools like PHP Nuke, Flat Nuke, created and developed by my friend Simon Belay, could be. Eventually, moving through Joomla and WordPress. He had it all. WordPress always seemed like the most suitable tool for the job, and I used it for many years. Even today, mainly on the sysadmin side, I manage hundreds of WordPress sites. Wow. And they are reasonably reliable, aside from the plugins, because the problem with WordPress isn't the software itself, yada yada, but many of the external plugins. That's a whole link of its own on YouTube. But this is precisely the problem. All dynamic CMS require constant and continuous security updates, because without them, the chances of defacement are extremely high. So discovering static site generators. And that's precisely why when I discovered Carlos Fenolosa's Bash blog in 2014, it immediately became clear that indeed there was no reason to continue down the path of dynamic CMS. I don't write often. I don't update often. There's no reason to regenerate all the content with every visit. Sure, WordPress caching plugins are often quite effective, but there are still add-ons that need to be kept on up to date. And I'm not a fan of adding things to streamline. Often, less is more. So he started using Bashblog for some of his secondary project until in 2015, he migrated his old Italian blog from WordPress to Pelican. Shortly after, I moved from Pelican to Nicola, and that blog is still generated by Nicola, although that blog's updates are now extremely rare, so much that I consider it almost abandoned. I also created the first Docker container for Nicola, and for a long time, I was listed among the deployment methods on their site. Oh, okay. So now it goes building of his own, BSSG. But Bashblog continued to fascinate me. So in 2015, for fun, I started developing my own static site generator from scratch. I called it, with little imagination, BSSD, the Bash Static Site Generator. The plan was for it to be compatible with the main OSs I use, to remain sufficiently simple and straightforward, 3 exclamation marks, and to be tailored to my needs. I intended to use it only and exclusively for small private things, starting with a sort of diary of mine, more professional than personal, and leave the official blogs to more tested and professional tools. Okay. As time went by, I added some small features I liked. Theming support, archives, tags, initially absent. Over time, many functions were added and the script grew large enough to make me pause and ask myself some questions about the long-term stability of the solution. So it remained only for my diary, which, however, grew year after year to the point where I needed to devise some kind of optimization. Then I developed, more fun than of real necessity, a caching system. On rebuild, only what needs to be rebuilt is reconstructed, making the operation sufficiently fast even as the number of posts grow. Obviously, there are limits. Using Bash and external tools, the efficiency cannot be compared to that of a proper programming language. He has also a brief detour to ITN blog, but I think we can safely skip that. So BSSG to the rescue. That's when I realized I would implement a few missing features needed to make ITN blog sufficiently complete, and this blog would be published using it, ensuring it be committed to its development. However, ITN blog is not mature enough to be released publicly, so for now it will remain the engine just for my blog. Then I thought again about BSSG. Development had stalled some time ago, but it was still in use. I figured that perhaps with a little tidying up, I could release it. So why choose BSSG is the question. BSSG is the result of a 10-year evolution. The code isn't extremely consistent. Some interesting features are missing, which I plan to implement, and it could use refactoring as the build script is monstrously large, but it works, it's portable, and much of the complexity increased precisely because of portability. And it generates sites that achieve very high accessibility and speed scores. So here are some highlights. Portability. It uses native OS tools like MD5 Sum on Linux, MD5 on OpenBSD and NetBSD. Portability itself added much of the complexity. Then there's simple theming. Themes are just simple CSS files, so the structure remains the same, simplifying theme switching or creating new ones. More than 50 themes are already available. Cool. Essential features. Supports RSS feed generation, sitemap XML, open graph tags to improve the social scoring, sharing, more like internationalization. The blog can be in languages other than English, but not multilingual, at least for now. Built-in backup and restore script. It will copy the configuration file, posts, and pages. Nothing else. Minimal dependencies. Markdown support. Posts and pages are in Markdown. Common Mark, Pandoc, and Markdown PL are supported. Feature images, optional GNU parallel integration. Ooh. To speed up build times when there are many posts. This feature significantly impacts the code and has caused me numerous headaches over time. But it's optional. If parallel isn't found, it proceeds traditionally. And only provides benefits with the number of posts increases. With few posts, performance actually degrades. High accessibility and performance scores. Sites with that are built with BSSG achieve excellent scores. And last but not least, it's BSD licensed, being released under a BSD license. Very cool. He talks a little bit more about the admin interface. And last but not least, BSSG is available today. Starting today, BSSG is publicly available. It's not perfect. It probably doesn't make sense to do something of this complexity in Bash. Development will proceed slowly, but it's here available to anyone who might find it useful. Happy blogging, anyone. So you can find it at bssg.dragas.net. Cool.
I think you should write your own static site generators, which Stefano did.
How hard could it be? I mean, if you it's have a hard. Rainy afternoon. Good work, Stefano. I mean, no, by
if,
no means.
If you're happy writing HTML, you can write a static site generator, which is just assembling some HTML.
Yes, go back to the old ways of doing things.
Okay, next we have a blog post on the... Wait.
Ah, here's now the news roundup.
Now it's time for the news roundup. And first in the roundup, we have a blog post on the FreeBSD Foundation website, which has no author. OpenZFS provides a lot of enterprise storage features in FreeBSD and other systems, developed and actively maintained by a worldwide open source community. OpenZFS receives new features, updates, and bug fixes regularly. Companies and users alike rely on OpenZFS for its rock-solid stability, data integrity, feature set, and cost-effectiveness. OpenZFS maintains its own documentation, its online help, man pages, and a comprehensive website. Really? Wait, no, we have to stop.
I think I wrote that article. accompany the cheat sheet.
Don't give away the secret.
JT will cut that part.
No, it's a secret.
Or blur it somehow.
Wait, but I don't know if this is documentation's documentation. I constantly, whenever I need any ZFS stuff, I Google ZFS thing, and then all the search results are Oracle, and then I add FreeBSD. And I thought, wow, I could add OpenZFS, but it doesn't seem to be the case.
They have some kind of good, push everything to the top page.
They're really good at SEO. It's almost like they have a lot of money.
Yeah.
Back to the article. Beginners may still feel overwhelmed using OpenZFS for the first time. Understanding ZFS terminology like clones, deduplication, third-party rate, scrub volume snapshots, and snapshots holds before using it in production settings is highly recommended. After all, you're storing your valuable data on ZFS and want to access it reliably with high performance. Both beginners and seasoned storage admins may need to look up ZFS features they want to deploy or what options to use in certain situations. To help OpenZFS, we created an OpenZFS cheat sheet that contains the most common features in a concise form. In the cheat sheet, you will find creating a storage pool, various RAID configurations, how to display status, import and exporting, datasets and their properties, scrub operations, creating ZFS volumes, snapshots and clones, dataset encryption to keep your data safe from prying eyes, delegating administrative functionality, sending and receiving snapshots over the network. To print this cheat sheet on a single page, front and back, fold it left and right in the middle of the column, and you'll have a short flyer-like piece of paper ready to look up the most important concepts. Ooh. And you made this in LaTeX.
Yes.
I can tell by the fonts.
It's not very in that regard, it's not very professional. It's the standard.
I can teach you LaTeX enough to do more fonts, Benedict. Oh, I can send a pull request. I'll just completely rewrite.
Yeah, you might as well. The cheat sheet is also on the foundation's GitHub page. So we already got someone who reported I think it was a typo or a repeated word or something.
Please provide LaTeX source for ZFS cheat sheet EN PDF file. So
I could provide you the source code, but then you would run away screaming.
But so then what's in the Git repo, Benedict?
Just a PDF.
How's that? That's not open source at all. It's just a PDF in a Git repo.
But people have reported stuff that's missing or wrong to the PDF, and then I uploaded a new PDF. I know. Well, I have no problem putting out the PDF or the tech file. I could do that.
Wait, no, I'm going to do this live. I'm going to add a comment.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Please add the source. I would like to make the fonts much less awful.
The problem is if the font changes, then maybe the spacing will move. And
yeah, it will. Yeah.
It will hard.
And now you find out why I hate writing academic papers.
Well, it could be an academic paper of sorts, but it's, yeah. I use what's the plugin? Save Trees or something that squeezes everything together?
Not allowed to do that for papers. You have to use the journal style.
Yeah.
So there's no point in learning LaTeX, apart from until you get to the point where you're like, this paper is a page too long. Let's go and trim every single sentence so that they all move up a little bit.
And that's exactly what LaTeX shouldn't be, like manipulating the defaults.
Yeah, no, it's almost like people are awful. I'm going to add a thumbs up.
Give you a lot of levers to pull.
How do you add reactions? There we go. Reaction. Thumbs up. Reaction. Rocket ship.
Oh, great.
I'm so sorry. I'm not doing this to you, Benedict. I'm doing it to the FreeBSD Foundation.
No, it's fine. No, there will be more. So last weekend, I was at Easter Hack in Hamburg giving two tutorials. I submitted two. I thought I was only getting accepted one, but both were accepted. The first one was ZFS, and the second was Vim, basic for beginners. And in the ZFS tutorial, I mentioned that I have this cheat sheet, and someone downloaded it, found it very good, said that to me, and the next day he came back to my Vim tutorial and told me again that this was a very useful cheat sheet for him.
Yeah, no, they're really good. We had a Jails cheat sheet FOSDEM, and it was super popular. It just disappeared. Yeah. I think they're good things to have. I, for a very long time, printed out and then blue tacked to the case of my PC at work, had the a snippet from a BSD Now tutorial on building world and kernels for doing updates, because the FreeBSD update process has been terrible for a very long time.
You could do a general FreeBSD cheat sheet, like how to run services, rcconf.
I think they're better focused. I don't think there was anything general you could put in a cheat sheet. Nobody is generally using a computer.
Yeah.
I did an interview last week that maybe will be on this podcast at some point. And at some point somebody said, we want FreeBSD to be a household name. And I said, nobody talks about operating systems at home.
It's, yeah, only the nerds.
I, you know, do a lot of operating system development. It's my job. And I don't talk about operating systems at home.
But you're not ashamed about it.
I'm not ashamed of it.
You'll talk about it for other reasons.
There's not enough. There's too many books in here for me to be visibly ashamed. But like, people don't talk about operating systems at home.
It's not a very topic that you can engage people in unless you have other developers.
Yeah, like, but there's no general use case, right? Like,
FreeBSD. Oh, you run Windows, so what? Yeah. Oh,
and there's no like a zero knowledge case either, right? Like, there's no way to get started with FreeBSD if you don't know anything about computers and operating systems. Because your first question would be like, cool, I have a command prompt, now what? Or, now I'm at a desktop, what do I do?
Yeah, it's very boring without icons and flashy things.
But yeah, no, really good. Thank you for putting it together. I think it's a great effort from the FreeBSD Foundation. Is it two pages? Yeah, it's two pages.
Yeah, back and so if
does it fold? Because a really difficult thing. Have you printed it out, Benedict, and tried?
Yeah, it's from a template that does exactly this kind of folding.
So the thing with printers,
you can also not fold it. You can just
no. Like the thing with laser and inkjet printers is that they're particularly not precise.
Yeah.
And so the printing error is like 5 millimeters on the long edge of the paper. And so if you have something like this to fold, it might be 5 millimeters off, and so front and back don't work. So I don't know, like, it might be fine for you on the printer you use and not fine for other people on the printers they use.
I just wait for people to request a US letter page paper because this is A4. And from the FreeBSD Foundation, they were like, okay, we should actually provide US
letter. You should put the you should write a script for generating these Benedict and put that in Git and have source and separate directories, and then you could have like a cheat sheets repo
and let people add to it and make changes. Ooh.
Or just, you know,
let it as it is. So
what repo is it in? It's in blog. You can get cheat sheets
comment
project.
About the cheat sheet on GitHub if you like
I have
it, don't
I'm
like
sorry
it, request feel, changes chip makes it all worthwhile.
I changed the wording of my comment to be less mean because I realized it's not you. Really.
I know
it's,
you by now. So.
It's going to be Mark. He doesn't know what I'm talking about. He's not here. Oh, we should get Mark on. I'll write that down.
Yeah. I mean, he started that and encouraged me to do that. So why not? While you're writing, I covered the next part of the episode, which is dipping my toes in OpenBSD in Amsterdam. This is from eWinter, without the E at the winter part, .nl. So sometimes the water is cold at first. So he has a little excerpt from a shell prompt. So nano KSH says nano not found. Then he tries, or Vim is tried, then says KSH Vim not found. A couple of years ago, I was playing with an ancient laptop, so Toshiba 300 CDT. Okay, never heard of it, but there's a link. I can't remember exactly, but I believe I had an internal memory of 32 members. It had an internal memory of 32 megabytes. Megabytes, people. Resources of the internet differ on the exact specification. Perhaps there were different models, but we are definitely talking about megabytes, not gigabytes. I was wondering whether it would be possible to get such an old device connected to the internet. You don't want that. Securely and do something real with it. Could it still be useful in some way, however limited? It was released in 1998. Back then, people had to do lists. They were using word processors and they went online to visit websites. Why wouldn't that still be possible? I started by looking into several small Linux distros like Damn Small Linux and Puppy Linux. Unfortunately, those proved to be too much for this old machine. I started a half-hearted attempt to do Linux from scratch, figuring that would be the most basic and minimal Linux possible, but that turned into a whole project in itself and I got distracted by other kinds of operating systems. I tried Haiku, Minix, and many, many more. This list is just what pops up in my head now, years later. Naturally, I got to the BSDs as well, but all to no avail. Nothing would work on this ancient laptop, the limited memory being the culprit most of the time. Well, nothing, except OpenBSD. Installing and seeing it boot was a puzzling moment. After all the failures, this one simply just worked. Funny, I just wanted something to play with. But because I was going to connect it to the internet, I wanted something secure and supported. And then the only OS that worked was the one people keep bringing up as the most secure operating system available. Yeah, see? That probably says something about the virtues of simplicity and minimalism. Oh, yeah. I did not use it very long, though. It took 15 minutes to boot, thanks to one of the security features. I could likely have disabled that, but learning obviously turned out to be a challenge. For a Linux user, it all looks so familiar. Yet, it is different enough that I just keep stumbling around and go nowhere. So package underscore add helix.
Yeah.
Package underscore add says must be run as root. Okay. Does do as package underscore add helix do as. Do as is not enabled. etcdoas.conf, no such file directory. Learning can be difficult. Learning it is taking something new and giving that a place in the model of the world that you already have to connect the new thing to the things you already know. If it is truly new, that might prove to be difficult. There is no obvious place in your mental model to put the new thing. You may think you are open-minded, that you are flexible enough to learn new things, but often that only means that you are ready for square pegs of various new sizes. What happens if you encounter a round one? It may take several failed attempts before the concept of roundness even emerges in your head. So do as RCCTL restart relay D. Failed. Sometimes you are the round peg. Take the term KYC. It stands for Know Your Customer, and it means that organizations must take steps to make sure you, a potential customer, are not a fraudster. They are required by law to learn who you are so they can determine if it's okay to start a business relationship with you. For me, getting to know someone simply means talking to them, preferably over some beer or coffee. For some, so that wouldn't work for me. Both beer or coffee is not a thing for me. Anyway, for many companies, getting to know you nowadays means asking you to stare into your webcam so that an AI can take a good look at you, or to submit a scan of your passport that they promise to process securely because your privacy is very, very important to them. Oh yeah, somehow I never believe it when they say that. So, but then I stumbled upon OpenBSD Amsterdam. A local offering of OpenBSD VMs. The organization pledges to use part of the money they charge for sponsoring the development of OpenBSD, which is cool. It felt no nonsense and rock solid like the OS itself. I've never met the people behind it, but I bet they like coffee or beer. Yep, do as relay D minus N. Cannot load key pair and so on. No actions, nothing to do. OpenBSD, there it is again. Remembering my earlier experience with the old laptop, I figured I needed to give it another try. After that, besides security, enthusiasts always keep raving about the documentation and the focus on creating a simple and coherent system. Perhaps I gave up on it too soon. Surely I should be capable of understanding that. I decided I should have another go. So a couple more tries. And then later, do as RCCTL restart HTTPD. The HTTPD says, okay. And okay. Do as RCCTL restart relay D says also okay. Originally, I planned to make this post a simple recipe, just follow these steps and make your website running in no time. But now I know it won't work like that, at least not for everyone. Instead, I'll just give you the list of resources I used in the first version of the configuration files that worked. And the ingredients you need to add is some time and effort. I think it's worth it, though it all feels rock solid. Technology that is simple and boring and is the best in the best way possible. Something you can depend on. Let it all sink in for a while. Give it some time. The water is nice once you get used to it. Beautiful round pufferfish swim there. They are fun to watch. Cool. And a couple of resources at the bottom. It's nice that OpenBSD is the only one that was actually running.
I was hoping that link would be to some pufferfish swimming, but I guess I will have to go and find that myself.
Yeah, disappointing.
Next up, we have a blog post from Jampiet Mens. SSH keys from a command line. SSHD's authorized keys command directive. Many people use some form of manual configuration management to create or manage content over remote machines. Home.ssh authorized keys files. Do people automate that? I don't automate this. And whether it's likes of Chef, Puppet, Ansible, or your particular poison, the principle is the same here. SSH public keys are copied into static files on the target systems. This works very well and is a well understood technology. The actual paths to these static files are configured server-side in sshd config. The parameter authorized key file defaults to .ssh/authorized keys, .ssh/authorized keys 2. I don't know why there's two.
Because
too many? And can easily be modified to accommodate local preferences or disabled entirely by setting it to none. I can add tokens to the pass which cause SSHD to use variable information to find a file. For instance, %u is replaced by the SSH username and %h is the user's home directory. See tokens in SSH config. For example, I can configure my servers to read public keys from a special directory on the file system I populate with keys per user and well-known file in their home directory and a fallback for all users.
Oh, no, keep going. He has a good case there.
As mentioned above, these files are static, and while it's easy to deploy them onto a machine, I remember to remove keys for users who are no longer supposed to log into a server because they left the organization. Certain environments want a central directory service to provide SSH public keys. The public user SSH keys are added to the directory service, and SSHD on a target machine queries the network directory service to determine whether the user is granted access. This works very well as long as the network is available, but what if it isn't? I tried to pay attention to the change logs and recall seeing a new mouth-watering SSHD setting in 2013. That's quite a while ago. For OpenSSH, there's a lowercase h there. For OpenSSH 6.2, an option called authorized keys command was added to the server. SSHD added a SSHD config option to authorize keys command to support fetching authorized keys from a command in addition to or instead of from the file system. The command is run under an account specified by authorized keys user authorized keys command user SSHD config. It's so hard in technical stuff sometimes. The program I wire up to this parameter can obtain SSH public keys, the same lines of data we otherwise encounter in an authorized keys file, from whichever source it wants to query. For instance, I could attempt to query LDAP, an LDAP directory server over a network, and fail to a local emergency list of keys stored in a database local to the server, thereby permitting a small group of administrators to actually log into the server. Let's look at the very simple example command to demonstrate this. Oh, I'm not reading that. Okay. User sbinsh echo public key file. Oh, it got wider. Wow, that's so weird.
Mm-hmm.
The fixed text boxes for examples, when you put a mouse over them, they get wider.
Ooh, sweet. I haven't moved the mouse over there.
Yeah,
but now that you mention it.
Not distracting at all. Ooh. That's it. It's not a joke. That is the simplest way to illustrate what the program has to do, namely emit public SSH key strings. We'll typically desire a bit more complexity, for instance, emitting public keys for specific users trying to log in. But I hope this example demonstrates how easy the technology actually is. An administrator, say, adds SSH public keys for users to an SQLite database and makes the database available on the server. How this file actually gets to servers is out of scope here, but it could be anything from manually copying over SFTP, a periodic rsync from cron, to using configuration management for deployment. The database can contain any number of columns I want to in determining whether a user is permitted to log into the system. Here for brevity, I'll simply check the existence of the user. Note how the pub key column contains a line we'd otherwise encounter in authorized key file. There's an example. I'm not going to read an SQL table on a podcast. The documentation recommends authorized keys command user to be a dedicated user, so I create one. I also install the program to the paths I've chosen, var cache ssh keys.db. I ensure the actual database belongs to the user which we're reading from it, and in particular, I protect the file to ensure the database cannot be read. And then there's a lot more example in some Python. This is really cool. You should go and read it. I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's now a lot of programming. Well, there's some code. Oh, it's WTFPL. But it's really cool.
Yeah, basically you can have backup accounts in a local SQLite database in case the LDAP is gone and you can still look up and log in.
The fallback keys file really confused me because I was like, but that would allow anyone in that list to log in as any user.
Yeah, but the... Actual accounts are in the SQL database with their...
Yeah, for this, but the first example where it said you could do this and have the fallback accounts, that would be for things like git at.
Ah, yeah.
So where multiple people can log in as that user, and so that would have a fallback file.
Hmm.
Whereas like if for me, if they use the fallback file, multiple people can use, they could all log in as me. but this is for machines that might not have that. They might have, you know, there's users on the machine for process isolation, and then there's like you can basically anyone gets on the machine, they can do Git from the machine.
Yeah, only that.
But they can't move around, and that's what the users are for.
Yeah, so that's why I thought this would be interesting to people who have a bit more requirements in the SSH space.
Definitely go read the whole thing and look at the fun expanding boxes.
Sometimes they expand without a need because they are small enough to fit the content.
Yeah, but they're probably just CSS as well. There's probably no JavaScript.
Probably.
That's cool.
All right. Then we have how to move a Beehive VM and jail container from one host to another host, because you may have the need.
Hey, I complained about this on the podcast.
Yeah, see, then Vincent Delft's blog is the rescue or has a solution for you. And he writes, after having played with Beehive VM and jail container in my previous posts, I'm investigating here how to migrate them from one host to another. Unfortunately, FreeBSD doesn't have a live migration yet. The patch is somewhere out there, but yeah, things are not in shape yet. But here you will see that downtime could be around 1 second. For many applications, such downtime is not noticeable. Introduction. Being able to move VM from one host to another is a feature that lots of sysadmins are looking for. It can be a better spread for the workload or to facilitate an upgrade, a maintenance activity, and so on. And when this can be done without impacting the end users, this is much better for everyone. I will explain how I did it for Beehive VM and for jail containers. Indeed, and already explained within a jail container, we have access to all VM files directly from the host. As you could guess, we could use tools like rsync to facilitate the task, or ZFSSend maybe. Beehive VM migration. Thanks to a tool called vm-beehive, we can easily perform such migration for Beehive VMs. Preparations. It's advised that both source and destination hosts have the same operating system, the same version, to keep it easy enough to migrate. In my case, both are running FreeBSD. The source machine, GhostBSD, is a laptop running GhostBSD 24.10, so FreeBSD 14.1. The destination machine, host destination, is running FreeBSD 14.2. Wait, didn't we just say that the host should have the same OS and the same version? Okay. On both source and destination, I've installed vm-beehive. On source host, I've created a VM running Alpine Linux and having the SSH daemon up and running permanently. I do not come back on the details to create a VM with vm-beehive, so you can find here the config. So there's a previous blog post, and the config is just for completeness sake here. Before we migrate, we will start it. So VM start Alpine VM. Rumbles off and starts going. So it shows up in the VM list. And to measure the downtime, I've built a small loop doing pings. So he pings the Alpine VM continuously and echoes if the ping is reachable, ping OK. And if the ping doesn't reach anything, then ping not OK. Information from this script will allow us to better see how long the VM will be down. OK, migration. Thanks to vm-beehive, the migration of a VM is really simple. VM, migrate, Alpine VM, and host destination, or destination host. More simple, this is difficult. In the short, you ask VM to migrate the VM called Alpine VM to the new host called host DST. Here are the results after the command. So attempting to send Alpine VM to host DS, remote data set. This is ZFS based, or it looks like it. Yeah, sending Zroot, okay. Taking snapshot, okay, then send snapshot is getting sent, attempting to stop the guest powered off, taking snapshot again after the power off, sending the Zroot incremental source, any changes that may have happened in the meantime while the sending was going on, and then the snapshot was also sent, and then attempting to start the Alpine VM on the destination, starting Alpine VM, and it's going there. So in short, the migration consists of take a snapshot called -S1, send it to the host, DS, since the first snapshot sent to DS, it takes quite a long time. In my case, this was a disk of 10 gigabytes, on which Alpine Linux takes about 255 megabytes of space. So we should have a lot of 0 bytes. Then the VM is stopped, an incremental snapshot is taken, which is normally very quick, and finally the VM is started. By doing this sync in 2 stages, we minimize the strict minimum, the downtime of the VM. To better see the amount of downtime, here are the results of the ping check script. So ping okay, ping okay, ping not okay, and so on. So how long? So from 9:59:46 to 9:59:55. So that is 9 seconds, the machine was not reachable. So to be clear, the first 2 pings, the VM run on GhostBSD host, and the last 2 pings, which are okay both, The VM runs on host destination. Amazing. And the ones in between are the 9 seconds where it's down. So, or 6 seconds, I can't calculate anymore. So 6 seconds of downtime, this is not bad. I do not have references with other hypervisors, but this sounds very good to my eyes. To be able to run a second migration, I first delete all of this. First migration was made on the host destination. This can be done by using ZFS destroy and of the two snapshots and ZFS destroy of the dataset. Thanks to VM migrate, we can do it a bit more clever and have a better control of when the migration can occur. Indeed, we can dissociate the two stages in two different commands. So time VM migrate dash one Alpine VM host destination. Okay, that's just the send and has a couple of seconds elapsed. And then he's taking some changes in a few files inside the Alpine VM machine to have a bit of data too that gets changed and sends that over as well incrementally. And that took nearly a couple milliseconds. All right, cool. And there's a bit more at the end about how we can migrate the Jails container, but I leave that to the curious listener. It's probably similar. Yeah, as ZFS sent to the rescue. Cool. That's the answer. Run ZFS. Or rsync. I mean, it just has to be transferred over, but there's no snapshots in rsync.
BSD Now is sponsored by Tarsnap. Everyone needs backups, and Tarsnap ensures that your backups are not only safe, but also secure. Your data is encrypted on your device before being sent to the cloud. You can be sure that only you have the ability to read your data. Tarsnap takes your data and works out what is duplicated. It then assembles the data into compressed blocks and creates them with your local private key. And this key never leaves your system. The data is then uploaded into the cloud. Even if someone is able to obtain your data in the cloud, they will not be able to decrypt it and access your files. Tarsnap is easy to use. If you can use Tar, then you can use Tarsnap. Tarsnap is prepaid, so you never have to worry about an unexpected bill. Tarsnap is fully open source, allowing you to inspect the code and make sure it does what we say it does. And Tarsnap has bug bounties so that if you find errors in the code, you can get paid for helping make the software better. With clients on all major platforms, there's no excuse not to have good backups. Go to tarsnap.com to learn more.
We have feedback and questions this week.
Woohoo. Do we? Oh.
Oh, Dave, in your continuous quest to get web stacks.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I can read this. Wait, I'm clicking. Yeah, I ask people stuff.
Oh, it's our Dave. The Dave.
Yeah, it's Dave.
All the Daves.
Dave. He sent a very long email.
Yeah, good.
John has promised us a long email we don't have yet. Dave writes, TLDR, there is nothing I cannot make more complicated than necessary. Which is funny, because the show we recorded last week, which isn't out yet, I did ask people to send the most complicated setups they have. And Dave must use the time machine. To serve my humble single-pay website, skunkworks.at, I have developed a veritable labyrinth of a stack. When a user requests my incredible single static page website, we of course look up skunkworks in DNS, my DNS. A DNS server I wrote myself because I can in an obscure functional programming language called Elixir. The DNS server looks up its records in a database, Apache Cloud DB, which is another well-known open source project that I've been contributing to longer than pretty much anything else in my life except drinking beer and skiing. One DNS server alone is simply not enough, as you all know. So I have a cluster of three in different autonomous networks using the lovely distdns.org DNS load balancer in front of them, just because I can. I did not write this amazing software either, and it possibly deserves a hug. Of course, one database alone is not simply not enough. As you all know, I have a three-node CloudDB cluster running in Jails on a FreeBSD 15 current kernel on separate servers on geographically distributed nodes within Europe because fault tolerance for my 0.1 user per hour website. In front of each CloudDB node is a HAProxy HTTP load balancer so that every DNS server is transparently dispatched to the closest in time and space CouchDB node that is up and ready for requests. I did not write HAProxy, but if I could hug it, I would. I love HAProxy. Is it called HAProxy?
No, it's HAProxy.
There was something about webpage. Yes, my webpage. From the amazing world of fault-tolerant services, clustered databases, and homegrown DNS servers, we now enter the non-fault-tolerant world of my home office and its garbage internet. Can you confirm? After our packets find their way across the internet, they eventually are confronted with my ISP-provided router. is complete garbage, but they require me to have it. So it's configured in transparent bridge mode and hands all packets off to a Traverse 1064 router, which is a nifty, tiny 8-core ARM64 router with 32 gigabytes of ECC RAM running FreeBSD 15 current. And it runs many, many jailed services on it, but it mostly runs PF and does firewalling and garbage cleanup my ISP, a large company, seems unable to do. The obvious thing would be to run the web server directly on the router, but as you're likely suspecting now, that's very unlikely. I, of course, run another load balancer. You love load balancers, Dave. It's HAProxy again. You're doing TLS termination, but for an added twist, it runs in a jail. Inbound web traffic arrives via the firewall, is dumped into a jail where HAProxy provides the port 443 TLS encryption and decides where to route most of the traffic. Normally, my desktop is also up and running, so HAProxy sends the traffic to a jailed instance of www/h2o, a web server that is no longer even has officially tagged releases, but periodically I update the snapshot from GitHub and redeploy it. I know the author of H2O, it's probably fine. But dear reader, what happens if my desktop is down? Well, the obvious answer is that as it runs FreeBSD 15 current, this can only be because it's rebooting to run a new kernel, or I'm on holiday and want to save some power. In that rare case, HAProxy on the router load balancer will serve a mostly identical website, but without some of the exciting content that is not directly linked to on the website, but is available to those who are in the know. I mentioned encryption, and of course I now use commonplace Let's Encrypt Acme protocol with a twist. No, not load balancers, but I want wildcard certificates for this, so I use DNS01 validation, proof of ownership of a domain, via DNS. The DNS server I wrote back at the top of this absurd little essay does this trick nicely. Of course, there's thousands of ways this could go horribly wrong, and sometimes it has, but mostly it does what it should, without intervention.
Just think about the debugging that requires, like, oh, the site is down. What could be the reason for that?
Everything's broken.
So go to Dave's web page to let all these bits and pieces work together.
Yeah, it's junk.
It's a good site. I mean, he's doing good work. No question about it. But it may sound a little bit over-engineered. It definitely would be resilient to any breakage.
His fonts are much better than the LaTeX default. He's got too many fonts, though. You should read that, Dave. You should read that book on fonts. Ping me about it. I'll try and remember what it's called.
Book on fonts that I haven't read.
How many books on fonts have you read?
Zero.
Yeah, totally, okay, so there's probably quite a lot.
So I have to start with one.
I don't think it's a good body font. I think I know what it is.
So you provide a web service critique.
Font critique, service. Definitely. Yeah. Yeah, far too many fonts, Dave.
The fonts could be better, or the pictures are too large.
Well, I didn't say that, but I would.
Yes, as an example.
Go to my blog and look at a picture, and you will see that it's less than a megabyte for every single picture, but they look
good. That's appreciated. So slow bandwidth users will definitely load your page quickly.
Okay, but then like when you click through, you will get a 32 megabyte image. And so you can have all the pixels you want.
Yeah.
I can do that because I wrote my static site generator, so it's not garbage.
Okay. So if you really want to get serious on the web, you have to write your own tools.
I think everyone should be writing their own web server.
Okay.
I don't think I've written enough FreeBSD to claim I wrote my own operating system.
There's still work to be done.
I could write an operating system. I just add it to my to-do list. There's not much on my to-do list. Operating system.
That's unusual for you. Is it the tech to-do list or the general to-do list?
Oh, I can't even distinguish them anymore.
Ah, they're merged into one?
Yeah, I don't know. So many notes everywhere. So much to do.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, Dave, for writing in. Yes. Thank you, everyone, for listening to us this week. If you would like to speak at us, you can join the Telegram at t.me/BSDNL. Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
If you would like to give us money, and we'd like money, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/BSDNL.
So that Tom can get a better camera without firmware.
I have a better camera, but you're not allowed to see video of me until you give us enough money.
Oh, yeah.
Blame JP.
For some people, that's not a feature, it's a bug.
Yeah, I know.
Other ways around.
Live video. Just video of the shows, maybe edited. But only if you join our Patreon at patreon.com/BSDNL.
Yeah.
patreon.com/BSDNL. Thank you.
Yeah, and till next week.
then. BSD then.